This podcast has never had ads or sponsors, thanks to the incredible support from our Patreon community. If you want to support independent space journalism, go to patreon.com/universetoday. Blue Ghost wraps up two busy weeks on the moon with a sunset. Good news, the Death Star isn't pointed at us, and a new option for the Mars sample return mission. And in a longer edition on Patreon, how supernovae could have caused two of Earth's mass extinction events. All this and more in this week's Space Bites. Well, it's time to wrap up our coverage of the Blue Ghost lander, and that is because it has reached the end of its mission. Well, okay, we'll probably report more when we find out more of the science. But anyway, now Blue Ghost landed on the surface of the moon on March 2nd, which was the beginning of the lunar day. It then had 2 weeks, 14 days to quickly do as much science as it possibly could before sunset and the lunar night set in. Of course, it's not equipped to be able to handle dealing with the cold temperatures for the lunar night, and so had to wrap everything up during the day. Now, it was able to test and deploy all of its instruments on the surface of the moon. For example, it used its planet vac to blast nitrogen gas and collect samples. Its lunar drill went down 1 meter into the lunar regolith. It tested an electrodynamic dust shield to see if they could repel dust off of the surface of the spacecraft. And then another experiment tested how regolith sticks to various material. It was able to track the GPS signals from Earth. It operated a radiation-tolerant computer as it passed through the Van Allen belts. It used a magnetotelluric sounder to measure the moon's electric and magnetic field. An X-ray imager captured images of the solar wind interacting with the Earth's magnetic field. Its cameras took 9,000 images during the mission, and it even deployed a retroreflector that scientists can use to accurately measure the distance to the moon. But I think one of the best parts of this mission was that it was on the moon during the lunar eclipse that was visible from here on Earth on the 14th. And so Firefly shared a bunch of really amazing images and sequences showing the sun going behind the Earth and then the Earth being surrounded by this red glow. An image of all of the sunrises and sunsets on Earth being seen at the same time. And then the sun returned and it was back to science operations. And so here we are. Blue Ghost has gone into that lunar night. There is almost no chance it will recover the next time the sun rises, but we will keep an eye on it and see what happens. And then the final image that we got from Blue Ghost was the sun setting below the horizon from the moon. Really cool image and a fond farewell. But the Japanese Slimlander survived a couple of nights, so here's hoping. And speaking of lunar landers, we reported on the failure of the recent Athena lander from Intuitive Machines. And about a year ago, they also failed with the Odysseus lander, where it landed hard, broke one of its legs, fell over sideways. But with the Odysseus lander, at least its solar panels were directed towards the sun. It was able to get power and able to send some signals back home. And so a lot of the experiments on board Odysseus actually operated for a short period of time. And so a paper came out last week talking about the ROLS-1 instrument, which was a radio telescope on the spacecraft. Now, we got a snapshot of the science because one of its antennae accidentally deployed as it was still en route to the moon. And then when it landed, it fell over on the side, crushed one of the four antennae that had deployed, but it was still able to do some science with the other three antennae. And so it had two main goals. One was, could it detect a techno signature? Could it detect the signals coming from a technological civilization? In other words, could it detect the radio signals coming from Earth? And it was able to do that. And then the second question was, could it detect the galactic background radio emissions? And this is sort of leading towards mapping the Milky Way's concentrations of hydrogen gas, looking for the 21 centimeter line of hydrogen emissions. And it was able to do that as well. It only operated for 20 minutes before it had to shut off. And so in that short period, scientists were able to demonstrate that the experiment worked, that the antenna worked, and that there are future missions that are going to build on that technology in the future. Good news, the Death Star isn't pointed at us. In 1999, astronomers directed the mighty Keck Observatory at a Wolf-Rayet star, designated 104. Now, Wolf-Rayet stars, these are very young stars, really at the very early stages of formation. They haven't gone into full main sequence hydrogen fusing in their cores yet. They're very unstable, they're very hot, put a lot of radiation, and they're still settling down to become a main sequence star. And from those observations, they realized that WR104 isn't one star, but it's actually two, a binary pair of these young stars orbiting around each other. And these are monsters. These are many times the mass of the sun, which means they're going to live very short lives, and then they're going to detonate as supernovae, or they might collide. Either case, astronomers think that this is a really good candidate for a gamma ray burst. And these are some of the most energetic explosions in the universe. We could see gamma ray bursts out to billions of light years away. A gamma ray burst went off in another galaxy, and we were able to detect the fluctuations in the atmosphere when the radiation hit Earth. And so gamma ray bursts are particularly terrifying because they can reach out and cause damage to your planet halfway across the galaxy. You get this initial flash of gamma rays, X-rays, and then ultraviolet radiation that can strip away the ozone layer from a planet, making it a lot more vulnerable to cosmic radiation. And so WR104 is one of the closest gamma ray burst candidates that astronomers know of. And when they made these first observations of WR104, they saw this pinwheel in the sky. And so it looked like the pinwheel was exactly face on. In other words, the stars could be pointing directly at Earth, and it's that beam that you want to avoid. And so good news, a new survey with Keck found that actually the stars are directed about 30 to 40 degrees away from us. And so if they do detonate as a gamma ray burst, the blast won't be pointed at us. And so we are safe from the Death Star. Updates on Mars sample return. In the last few months, we've been giving you updates on what's happening with the Mars sample return mission. NASA's Perseverance rover has collected all of these pristine samples of the surface of Mars, the atmosphere of Mars, collected them in its tummy. It's ready to meet with a spacecraft to hand these samples over so they can be brought back to Earth. And so then scientists can study them in the greatest labs on Earth and then really get to the bottom of a lot of these long-standing questions about Mars. Was it ever habitable? Is there any examples of life in these samples? It'd be great to get those samples back to Earth. And so one of the great plans for NASA was the Mars sample return mission. But over time, the budget on that mission looked like it was going to get higher and higher. And eventually, they decided to go back, recalibrate, and try to get some new ideas on how they could carry out the Mars sample return mission. And they came up with sort of two strategies, one which was to go with a fairly simple version of the Mars sample return mission, and then another one is to use a commercial provider like SpaceX or Blue Origin to send a lander to pick up the samples. But both of those were in the high $7 to $8 billion range and would still take into the 2030s to deliver. So we got a really interesting editorial from Peter Beck. He's the CEO of Rocket Lab, and he is proposing that Rocket Lab can do the mission for $4 billion or less. And he's willing to take a fixed price contract on that using very well understood heat shields, landers, propulsion systems. They think that they can go land near Perseverance, collect up those samples, deploy off the surface of Mars, and bring them home to Earth, all within that $4 billion budget. So your move, NASA? And not only within that $4 billion budget, but they think they can have those samples back on Earth by 2031, which is close to the time that the Chinese are planning their sample return mission. Speaking of the Chinese sample return mission, we got a lot more information this week from what their plans are, and they're opening up their mission to international partners. The mission is called Tianwen 3, and they're going to be launching that in 2028, and they're hoping to receive the samples by 2030. So, you know, if Rocket Lab's going to get that job, they better hurry. They set aside 15 kilograms on the return spacecraft and 5 kilograms on the Mars orbiter, and they're opening that up to international partners to be able to propose instruments and experiments that could run on both of these to gather additional science above and beyond the sample return mission. And so if various international partners want to do some science, they can participate that way. And China says they've narrowed down the landing site. They've got 3 proposed landing zones. They're probably going to include a rover as well as a helicopter to help retrieve samples and explore the environment around it. So it's a pretty exciting mission, and it's just around the corner now. Euclid's first deep field. The European Space Agency's Euclid mission is now into its full operations. It is scanning the universe to really track the evolution and history of the cosmos over billions of years. It's looking all the way back, beginning at about 10 billion years ago, and then measuring the evolution of the universe over time, watching as the influence of dark matter and dark energy are having on galaxies and the large-scale structure of the universe. And so to be able to do this, it's scanning the entire sky over and over and over again. It's got two surveys that it's doing. One is a fairly shallow survey where it's going relatively quickly and gathering as much information as it can, but it's also doing three deep field surveys, very similar to the Hubble Space Telescope, but to the next level. And so this week, the European Space Agency released the first data set from the first deep field. And this is crazy. It's got just 1 week of observations and it contains 26 million galaxies. And the farthest of these is 10.5 billion light years away. And eventually, it will scan this exact same region dozens of times through its entire mission. And so it'll add even more galaxies to that number. It's found gravitational lenses, galaxy clusters, and unusually shaped galaxies, most of which have never been cataloged before. And this is only 0.4% of the total galaxies that it's going to be finding. So, you know, this is a great start for Euclid. I think Euclid has now taken the spot for the mission that I'm most excited about now that Gaia is no more. Every week we do a vote on our channel where you tell us what you thought was the best story of the week. And the winner last week was the announcement that we're looking at probably a 50% cut to NASA's science funding. So thank you everybody who voted on that last week. And we're going to post a new vote for this week's space news into the channel. So check out the post tab on YouTube. But if you're just scrolling on your phone and letting the algorithm feed you various information, just vote when you see our new poll come through. And then next week, we'll look at the results and celebrate the winner. Now, of course, the best chance is to subscribe to the channel, click on the notifications bell, and then just obey the algorithm. Carbon dioxide in giant planets. One of my favorite exoplanetary systems is HR 8799. We all have favorite exoplanetary systems, right? So this one is really special because it was first discovered in 2008. And it's a fairly young star, just a few tens of millions of years old, and it's about 133 light years away from us. It has four giant planets that are far enough away from the star that they can be observed directly. And so there are some just incredible animations that astronomers have made over the last almost two decades, watching as these planets are going in orbit around this star. And this isn't an artist's illustration or an animation. This is an actual time-lapse video of these planets in orbit around that star. And so, of course, James Webb needs to get into this fun. And so we learned this week that they did observations of the planets at HR 8799 with JWST. And normally, Webb analyzes the atmospheres of planets by using the transit method. So you've got the planet, it's passing in front of the star, and then Webb is able to measure the combined light coming from both the star and the planet. And then it measures when you only have the star. It can also measure when the planet goes behind the star. And then you can, with enough of these observations, you can detect the presence of various chemicals in the atmosphere as you sort of subtract out the star. But in this case, Webb just looked at the planets and detected the presence of carbon dioxide in their atmospheres. And that's incredible. This is a preview of what we're going to see when the Habitable Worlds Observatory comes online, where we've got this telescope capable of detecting Earth-sized worlds orbiting around sun-like stars. And it's going to be measuring their atmospheres directly. It's not going to be trying to wait as they transit in front of the star. And so just an incredible observation from Webb and just a really interesting preview for what's coming with future observatories. The Square Kilometer Array is online. Now, we've been talking about a lot of super telescopes that are getting developed. Obviously, James Webb is the one that has already been launched, but right around the corner, we've got the Giant Magellan Telescope. We've got the European Extremely Large Telescope. And then one that we don't talk too much about is the square kilometer array. And this is like, it's what it describes, which is that you're going to have a radio telescope that consists of 1 square kilometer of surface area. Now, it's broken up into an enormous number of smaller radio telescopes, and it's going to be deployed in 2 different sites, 1 in Australia and 1 in South Africa. And we're not going to see the full operations of the square kilometer array into about 2030, but they've already deployed the first 1,000 antenna in Australia, and they released their first image. And keep in mind, that's only 1,024 of their telescopes. Eventually, they're planning to have 131,072 antennae in this constellation of telescopes. And so this picture encapsulated 25 degrees across and contained 85 of the brightest known galaxies. And eventually, it will see 600,000 galaxies in this same region. What's really amazing about the Square Kilometer Array, it's going to be able to produce images that are a lot more familiar to the kinds of stuff that we see when we look at pictures coming from the Hubble Space Telescope. You know, and for the longest time, radio images have been very low resolution. You only get a few pixels, but when you have 131,000 antennae working together, you're going to get just ludicrous resolution. It's going to be able to detect radio sources across the universe at a scale that has just never been done before. 2030 can't come soon enough. That's Deimos. The European Space Agency's Hera mission is on its way to the asteroid combo Didymos and Dimorphos. If that sounds familiar, NASA's DART mission crashed into Dimorphos a couple of years ago. And so Hera is being sent to measure the aftermath, see what happened to Dimorphos and Didymos after the DART mission wrapped up. And to be able to make this journey, it did a flyby of Mars. As it was doing a flyby of Mars, they had timed it so they would also do a flyby of Deimos, which is Mars' smaller moon. This is a great target. I mean, when it gets to Dimorphos and Didymos, it's going to be analyzing asteroids, and Deimos looks very much like an asteroid. So it came within 1,000 kilometers of Deimos and took this black and white image. And then Andreas Luck made a colored version of it. It looks really cool. And so it's completed this flyby of Mars. It's on its way to Didymos and Dimorphos. We'll arrive there in 2026. Now, you're watching this week's Space Bites. I'm writing my weekly Guide to Space newsletter. This is where I cover dozens of stories that we don't have time to get to here on the show. For example, Vera Rubin just got its camera installed. NASA's Punch and SpheriX missions safely blast off. Suni Williams and Butch Wilmore finally get to come home. My newsletter goes out every Friday to 70,000 of my closest friends. It's completely free. I write every single word. Go to universetoday.com/newsletter to sign up. I hate ads, and that's why you never see sponsorship messages or even mid-rolls on this channel. I remove every single ad that YouTube allows me to. Unfortunately, I can't remove ads in the beginning of the videos here, but I can provide the same video with no ads on Patreon. And it's not behind a paywall. It's free for everyone. And we even include a bonus story, which this week is all about the possible connection between supernova explosions and mass extinction events on Earth. Follow the links in the description. I'm going to talk about a really cool series of stories that we're doing on Universe Today. But first, I'd like to thank our patrons. Thanks to Abe Kingston, Andrew Gross, Bear Lake Roofing, Brian Boddy, Keredwin, Cy Nelson, David Gilton, and David Matz, Dustin Cable, Evan Pro, Greg Feely, Hen Schultz, Hudson Moore, James Clark, Jeremy Mattern, Jim Burke, Jordan Young, Josh Schultz, Lawrence Federico, Michael Purcell, Paul Rohrbach, Ren Kaidu, Robeck, Sean Sargent, Spiderswap.io, Stephen Fowler-Munley, Thomas L. Skadron, Vlad Shiplin, and Wolfgang Klotz, who support us at the Master of the Universe level. And all our patrons, all your support means the universe to us. So thanks to everybody who has recently supported us on Patreon and allowed us to go completely ad-free on the website. This has allowed me to greenlight a bunch of stories that I've been holding off of because I wasn't sure that we had the funding and I didn't want to extend our writing budget. And so now I feel a lot more comfortable. And so I've said yes to a bunch of stories that I'm really excited about. And so there's sort of 2 main groups. One is that Matt Williams is doing a 5-part deep dive on all of the science that we're going to be expecting from Cycle 4 from James Webb Space Telescope. And these are all of the observations that are going to happen over the course of 1 year. And we've broken it up into exoplanets and the early cosmos and supermassive black holes and cosmic dawn and in the solar system and more. And so each one is really long and really good. So we'll put a link in the show notes to the beginning of that series and you can follow through with that. And then the other one is that we recently had the Lunar and Planetary Science Conference in Houston, and there were just so many amazing stories, new missions, new discoveries. You're getting this direct report from various scientists. And I went through all of the abstracts of the conference. I found about 30 stories that I think we should be covering on Universe Today. And so we're going to be trickling those out over the coming weeks. Now, of course, we'll cover a bunch of those here in Space Bites. You'll see them in my newsletter and, you know, some of the best stories. I'll try and find interviews to talk to the scientists about what they discovered. So again, thank you for helping us out and enjoy all of the science, which I hope you're not going to be able to find this anywhere else. And it's all available completely for free. All right. We'll see you next week.